Hello, and welcome to the Panda Podcast. My name is John Burgess, and I will be your host as we deep dive into all things tanks. I want to begin right off of the bat with saying happy holidays and especially bountiful New Year to you all. Thank you to everyone who took advantage of the holiday sticker sale. Much appreciated. For those of you who missed the sale, well, sorry. There will be others, possibly down the line, but don't fret. You can still purchase a sticker from the Panzer Shop at thepanzerpodcast.bigcartel.com. Now, I know some of you were expecting some sort of holiday episode in December, and so was I. I was also expecting to release an episode over our December mini holiday break. Well, some big changes happened in December. Miss Podcast and I have become engaged, and we will soon become Mr. and Mrs. Panzer Podcast. So that's very, very exciting. If you'll forgive me for not releasing a fun story over the winter break, we can move right along into today's episode regarding our medium tank, M3. So even though I may have been lacking on releasing a holiday episode, that does not mean I was slacking on my self-induced homework over the holidays. In fact, I've been keeping up with my reading just so that I could kick off January strong and get right back into the meat of the series within the series on the M3 medium tank. With pleasantries and housekeeping items out of the way, what do you all say we dive right back in? When we last left off, we were discussing both versions of the M3 medium tank, which includes the M3 Grant, the British version, and the M3 Lee, the American version. Now, before we get back into one side or the other, I wish to reiterate that for all intents and purposes, the main difference was the turret. However, there were subtleties within each branch of vehicle. So we're going to get into a bit of an overview, because there is plenty of overlap, and I wish to untangle the nest now, rather than doing so in an ad hoc manner. I will, of course, reiterate throughout the series when we are focusing on particular vehicles. And with that said, here is the basic way in differentiating the different models of the M3 medium tank. I have two charts in front of me. The first one is going to describe each M3 Lee and its designation, along with the engine and fuel type, because those things are different and they lend themselves to the different versions of the M3. So we'll start right off the bat. The plain M3, which would have been the Grant 1 and the Lee 1, was a gasoline engine that we are somewhat familiar with, the Continental R975. That engine and the gasoline fuel was used in the Lee No. 2 and the M3A1. There is no Grant 2, it should be known. Finally, of the R75 engine versions, the Grant 1, the Lee 3, and the M3A2. We will discuss why the British still considered the M3A2 the Grant 1, but a little bit later. Next up, the British don't have a version of this one. However, the US would be the Lee 4 or the M3D for diesel, which was running the Guybrison T1400-2 diesel engine. Next, we have the Grant 2, the Lee 5, or the M3A3 Delta, or D, for diesel, which was using a General Motors 6046 diesel engine. Next, the British do not have a Lee 6, like the Americans do, nor do they have the M3A4. Now, I must reiterate here, when I say Lee 6 and M3A4, that is the same vehicle. We're going to get in that in just a moment here, but Anyway, the M3A4 was a gasoline engine built by Chrysler known as the A57. Last but not least, we have the Grant II, the Lee 7, and the M3A5, which was also running the General Motors 6046 diesel engine. The most notable difference is going to be, you know, the engine type and fuel type. This is just a brief, so I'm not going to go into the details until we finally land on these specific variants. For what it is worth, some of these, like the Lee 4 or the M3 diesel, which was fitted with the Giberson T1400-2 engine, were very short-lived failures. Less than 30 were produced. So we will be spinning through some of these variants without spending much time on them, as they were dead-end side projects, much like your favorite band when they just wanted to go in a new direction. Yeah, stick with the hits, buddy. And not for naught, it is a good reminder to keep it in your head that the subtle designations of these vehicles did not necessarily equate to better models, but rather different models of the same vehicle. I think we'll begin to see how the Allied methodology for production versus that of the German method was much different. The most obvious being interchangeability, along with the mass production qualities these vehicles all portrayed. Now, I know we just went over the list of the different types of engines and fuel types. So what I'm going to do here is kind of do the same thing, but now we are going to be talking about the different armor types. So we'll start off with the Grant 1, Lee 1, or M3, which was a rolled homogeneous armor of riveted plates. The armor on the turret was cast, and actually I'm only going to say that once, since all of the turret's armor was cast on all of the versions of the M3 medium tank. Next, we're going to exclude the Brits, but the Lee 2, or the M3A1, was actually kind of a hybrid. It had a rolled homogeneous armor lower and a cast upper hull. Next, we have still the Grant 1, the Lee 3, or the M3A2, which was rolled homogeneous armor, which was welded plates instead of riveted or cast. Next, the British are excluded once again. The Lee 4, or the M3D for diesel, was an RHA, or rolled homogeneous armor, made of riveted plates. Next, the Grant 2, the Lee 5, or the M3A3D, was also RHA, welded plates. Next, the British are excluded. The Lee 6, or the M3A4, was RHA riveted. Finally, the Grant 2, Lee 7, or M3A5 were also RHA riveted plates. So this list reckons with the different types, styles, and assemblies of each of the variants and their armor. We will discuss the differences with thickness and armor shape of each variant as well when we get there. There are some changes here and there that will be something to look for, but for the most part, the vehicles could be classed, just like by engine type, with their armor type. Essentially, the main difference was either riveted versus welded hulls. The exception, of course, is the M3A1, which was a combination of rolled homogeneous armor lower and a cast upper hull. Fun stuff. What's interesting for me here is that the combination of welded and cast hulls would extend further into the M4 Sherman's life as well. Even the hybrid part, cast part welded hulls would continue in certain Sherman builds from particular manufacturers. I am being, of course, intentionally vague, as we're not there yet in the story, and I can't recall off the top of my head exactly which models of the Sherman had the composite hulls. The exception, of course, being the riveted style of armor plate, which would be phased out after the M3 medium tank was retired. Well, actually, sort of. We will cross that bridge once we get there. For the time being, however, we're couched here in our little world of M3 medium tanks. Our first stop is going to be one of the radial-engined M3 medium tanks. This is the original M3, which came in both the Grant and Lee varieties. It is worth noting here that I will reference each vehicle by its M designation. Not just because of my clearly American bias with vehicles, kidding, sort of, but because the M designation is the most specific. What I mean by that is, the Brits call all of their vehicles either the Grant 1 or, in the latter variants, the Grant 2. We could use the Lee variants as they do go through each Lee 1 through Lee 6 or even, you know, the Lee 7. It depends on who you ask. The Lee 7, I've seen that abbreviation a few times. However, the M designation does it all for us. It allows us to better detail the vehicle itself, since the chassis and hull would be the same for each of the Grant and Lee variants, while also explaining whether or not this variant included both a Grant turreted version or just a Lee turreted version. I will point it out when it does become relevant, so until then, assume each M designation contains both a Grant or British version and a Lee or American version. Got it? Fantastic. So, what do I mean by the rad M3? I mean, it's a pretty sick vehicle, dude. Pretty gnar. But really, what I mean by the radial-engined M3 is simply that the engine was a radial engine. Or, for the layman like yourself, an aircraft engine. Now, I know we have already gone over the particular engine that was dropped into the engine compartment of the M3 medium tank, but I did come across a few noteworthy items that I wanted to include. For one, the 9-cylinder Wright-built R975 Whirlwind radial engine was a 4-cycle static supercharged gasoline motor. Cool, right? But what does it all, you know, what does all that mean? For those grease monkey gearheads out there, I'm sure you're all rolling your eyes as you know what's coming. My very shitty explanation of some of this terminology. Don't worry, you can email me later your disgruntled opinions. For the rest of you, let's tuck in. It all began in 1801, when French inventor Philippe Le Bon invented an engine which improved upon Robert Steele's engine. It used coal gas ignited by an electric spark. Okay, actually, no. We're going to fast forward just a bit. I assume we are all aware of what an internal combustion engine is, and if we aren't, that is your homework assignment this week. For everyone else, let's move on. If I were to say something like a V6 or a V8 engine, you probably could conjure an image in your mind's eye. But what about if I said an inline 6 engine, or an inline 9, or a straight 12 engine? Well, okay, that's disingenuous. An inline or a straight line engine configuration, it's the same thing, different name. Essentially, aligns all of the cylinders, one after another, from the front to the rear of the engine. Whereas a V-style configuration contains an equal number of cylinders on each side of the engine in a loose V shape. There are bonuses to each, and, you know, there are some trade-offs to each. An inline engine is generally taller and narrower, which forces engine compartments to accommodate those engines in very particular ways. If you'll recall for a moment in the earlier episodes of the Sherman series, when we were describing J. Walter Christie's endeavors as a race car driver, you might have seen in those days long, narrow front ends on vehicles of the time. Generally speaking, that is because the engines were all of the inline variety, and thus required a much longer and narrower engine compartment to fit the engine. Depending on the size of the inline engine, you could also mount them transversely, allowing for a smaller front end. However, when you shrink it down to do that, you have to remove cylinders and, ultimately, lose power. Enter the V-style engines, which were designed to sit lower with an improved center of gravity. This created a much more space-efficient design, which also allowed a greater number of cylinders in a smaller engine compartment. Before anyone blasts off on me, yes, there are horizontally opposed engines. We know that because Christie invented them, also known as flat or boxer engines. Those don't really apply to armored fighting vehicles, but they certainly do apply when discussing, I don't know, Porsche or Subaru vehicles of the more modern age. So I am not going to bore us with that non sequitur. Instead, I want you to remember this whole thread we're pulling on is, of course, talking about the radial engine, which we haven't even talked about. Some of you, I am aware, know what a radial engine is. However, some of us aren't all that familiar, since you've probably never in your life seen a ground-based vehicle with a radial engine in it. Unless, of course, you've spent any time around particular armored fighting vehicles and the like. Or, you know, more commonly, you'll find them in propeller-driven aircraft. Older propeller-driven aircraft. A radial engine is, for all intents and purposes, an engine in which the cylinders form sort of like spokes in a wheel, which are around the engine block itself. The engine block, which resided within the center of this bloom of pistons. The Wright Model R975J-9-6 nine-cylinder radial engine was just one of these types of engines. Nine cylinders surrounded the engine block and produced, on paper at least, 400 horsepower at 2400 RPMs. Though, realistically, 340 horsepower at 2400 RPMs. This produced 890 foot-pounds of torque at 1800 RPM on paper, and 800 foot-pounds of torque at 1800 RPMs in the real world. Or, using more modern nomenclature, the engine produced 1200 newton-meters of torque on paper, or realistically, 1,000 newton meters of torque in practice. Wait, what the hell is foot-pounds or newton meters of torque? So, without going too much into it, torque is how you measure the strength of your engine. Horsepower has a lot to do with it, but without torque, you're just spinning that RPM gauge up and making a whole lot of noise. For instance, a Porsche 911 has between 331 to 590 foot-pounds of torque, or 450 to 800 newton-meters of torque at 2500 RPMs. Meaning, the little Carrera can go 0 to 60 miles per hour in 4 seconds. That's pretty fast. If we were to compare that to, say, my Toyota Corolla, which only has about 126 foot-pounds of torque, or 170 newton-meters of torque, giving her the lightning speed of 0 to 60 miles per hour in 8, closer to 9 seconds. Pretty not fast. So how does that compare? Okay, well, the Corolla weighs 3,000 pounds, or 1,350 kilos, while the Porsche weighs 3,500 pounds, or 1,500 kilos. Compare that to the M3 medium tank, which comes in at 61,500 pounds, or 27,900 kilos. That's a huge bitch when comparing the three. Especially since the M3 has only a marginal increase in torque when compared to the sports car. Maybe not a fair comparison, but I'm trying to make a point and doing so poorly, but I am making a point. Engines that require a lot of power, such as for towing a trailer or caravan, or I don't know, moving 61,000 pounds of medium tank across the globe kicking in the teeth of fascist, requires more torque than those who do not, like my Corolla. So, having a lot of torque just makes sense for armored fighting vehicles. And no, for those of you wondering, I do not know what the M3's 0-60 time is. My guess is it's unavailable since the vehicle, even when bare-ass naked, could never achieve that top speed. So why radial engines then? Well, we'll get into it a little bit, but essentially, aircraft engines are, quote, excellent for armor use due to their high horsepower to weight ratio, end quote. That is, of course, according to Mr. David Doyle in his, what I would like to call the M3 Bible, but is actually called M3 Lee Grant, the design, production, and service of the M3 Lee medium tank, the foundation of America's tank industry. I think M3 Bible is better, but who the hell am I? It's a lovely book, and I can officially say that this was a supporter-driven purchase. So thank you to everyone who has ordered stickers from the Panzer shop. You guys fucking rule. Obviously, aircrafts want to go fast, but things like an engine block and all the bells and whistles that come with an engine can be heavy. So, creating the lightest possible powerful engine for aircraft is not only a suggestion, but a requirement. And yes, a 30-ton tank isn't necessarily a lightweight anything. However, saving weight anywhere possible is always going to be a good thing. Almost every single piece of armor from this era is essentially overweight. And not that I mean they need to hit the treadmill or elliptical, but what I say really is every suspension system, tracks, transmission, you name it, was being heavily or especially overtaxed by the sheer weight of these vehicles. So anywhere you could add a lightweight and also available aircraft engine, that was just going to be what the doctor ordered. Of course, there were going to be some shortcomings to throwing an aircraft engine into an armored fighting vehicle. One of those being a somewhat obvious problem by way of simple observation. Cooling. Remember, aircraft engines have the benefit of being cooled, usually, by the propeller of the aircraft, which pulls air over, past, and through the engine. And hell, once in flight, the air very quickly cools down. Typically speaking, for every 1,000 feet of altitude gained, or 300 meters, the temperature drops by 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, or 2 degrees Celsius. So if the air temperature at sea level is generally about 59 degrees Fahrenheit, or 15 degrees Celsius, which is what aviation folk consider to be the, quote, standard temperature, end quote. That means at 10,000 feet, or 3,000 meters, the temperature can drop to as low as 23 degrees Fahrenheit, or negative 5 degrees Celsius. The reverse is also true. For those of us who live in Southern California, we experience what are known as the Santa Anta winds, which are technically fawn winds, which are a terrible, awful, son-of-a-bitch phenomenon that can quickly turn a nice, pleasant day into a fucking heat wave. Essentially, mountain air is pushed down thousands of feet, where it then resides in the LA basin and just causes the temperature to rise sharply. The wind is blowing, and it becomes dry as hell as the forces of this hell wind just come in and take everything out. It's miserable. And I've lived here my whole life. They happen all the time, but it's a miserable thing. But enough about my problems. We are talking about engine cooling problems and how the right R975 engine is affected by them. And how, you know, by sticking an engine that is normally cooled by the elements, is now stuck inside of an armored metal box. See what I mean by simple observation? That's an incredibly different situation for cooling purposes. So how did the M3 combat this? Well, first, an aluminum 14-blade axial flow fan was installed on the flywheel of the engine. Unfortunately, this wasn't quite enough. So a grill was installed on the engine deck to improve airflow by drawing air in from the outside and over the top of the engine. With this small modification, a couple variations would have to be made in order for the R975 radial to fit and operate properly within the confines of the M3. The crankshaft itself was shortened by a few inches, different valve timing for the pistons, and using automatic spark advance or magnetos to increase overall engine performance. These are not what I would consider wholly revolutionary ideas, but this kind of workaround was required to make an aircraft engine roll thunder inside of an armored fighting vehicle. The initial testing of the R975 in the M3 medium tank proved less than desirable results. While the prototype batch of M3s that were being tested by the Army on maneuvers in Carolina and Louisiana, it was noted that the engine produced less than 280 horsepower on average, and the service life was barely reaching a maximum of 100 hours. This is not the reliability that American tanks would become known for, at least at this stage. I mean, 100 hours? That's garbage time. However, luckily, for the M3 and the entire armored production of the United States military, the engineers at Wright were on the case, and they were going to get to the bottom of these issues. And what do you know? These problems, and many smaller issues, were all tracked down and the culprit identified. Cooling. I know, it's always cooling. But why was the cooling so poor? Well, the intake and exhaust systems were kinda shitty. The original Vortox U7X18C air cleaners installed on the M3 to support the R975's cooling system were mounted on the inside of the engine compartment, towards the rear wall of the vehicle. Air was expected to move through the fighting compartment, into the sponsons, and finally through these two air cleaners before finally being necked down to a 3.5-inch uninsulated carburetor tube. Actually, it was a set of tubes, so there were two of them. I know the inflection in my voice is indicating to your ears and mind that this was a problem, but initially, everyone thought this was going to be fine, that this would work. So let's break down why this truly was an issue. Moving air through all of those compartments, not ideal. Ambient engine heat and five hot, sweaty dudes warmed the intake air to about 180 degrees Fahrenheit or 82 degrees Celsius. Now that's hot. Some of you may be wondering, well, how hot is too hot? The answer, this is too hot. Expanding hot intake air meant that less fuel would enter the cylinders, resulting in a steep loss of power. And this was just the intake side of the problem. Further diagnosis indicated that exhaust systems were incredibly ineffective due to the excessive gas back pressure, which, if I can steal a definition from a buddy and his muffler shop, thanks, buddy. Quote, exhaust back pressure is the phenomenon that involves a significant drop in the pressure coming from the engine. Any liquid fuel that is made to pass through a pipe leaves drag on the walls of this pipe. The pressure drop takes place throughout the pipe, which means that the pressure that enters at one end of the pipe is lower than the pressure that leaves at the other end. This effect is called back pressure. End quote. Now, I'm not going to lie to you and pretend that I wholly understand what that means, but what matters here is that the exhaust system on the M3, known as the pepper pot style mufflers, caused this back pressure to occur. The common symptoms of back pressure include reduced power, poor fuel economy, slipping transmission, and ultimately failure. So if we go back and look at the chief complaint, reduced engine power and 100-hour service life, it's pretty safe to say that our culprit is the cause to these problems. Not to be done in by some shitty muffler, the folks at Wright conducted several tests and experiments between August of 41 through to January of 1942 to figure out just how to remedy this issue before it was too late. The solution invariably was to design this entire configuration from the mess it was to something much more operational. The in-tank arrangement was changed so that air no longer was pulled into and through the fighting and engine compartment to instead be drawn directly from the outside, from the fan shroud. This much cooler air was then routed through tubes which had now been insulated with asbestos, a topic we might have to dedicate some time to at some point. So, through the asbestos tubes, or tubes surrounded by asbestos rather, and into the Vortox oil bath air cleaners, which were now mounted on the outer rear wall of the engine compartment. And for those wondering, the purpose of the oil bath air cleaners was to simply separate dirt from the air that was ultimately going to pass through the engine. Which, if you were unaware, dirt and other particles are not good for engines at all, so keeping them debris-free is the way to be. Ultimately, this repositioning of the air cleaners also allowed their servicing to be much easier, as well as the added benefit of much cooler air being drawn into the engine. Finally, the old pepper pot style mufflers were replaced by straight through Marmont produced mufflers, which exited through the rear of the tank parallel to the stream of cooling air. In order to accommodate these new mufflers, the exhaust collector ring was redesigned to discharge the gases at the top of the engine rather than at the bottom. This somewhat simple solution collectively added to an increase of, wait for it, 13 to 75 horsepower overall, and could directly be attributed to the following improvements: an increase in power, an increase in fuel economy, and an increase in that service life. All right, check. Check and check. All of the issues the Army had with the M3's engine had seemingly been sated, at least for now. It would not take long for another contentious matter to rear its ugly little head and create yet another headache that would need to be dealt with. Production. But wait, you're saying to yourselves, in the mighty words of Stan Marsh, I thought this was America. How can there be production issues on a vehicle that was supposed to be the most mass-produced tank ever? Well, the Wright Corporation was an airplane engine manufacturing company with quite a limited production capacity. This lacking of abilities was becoming more and more present in the minds of the War Department, and especially of the United Kingdom, who had just spent a lot of fucking gold bullion to get to the production facilities and their order up and ready. So what gives? Were the Americans reneging on their agreement already? I knew it. Those dirtbag lazy sons of... Stop right there. Let's zoom out a little bit and bear this in mind. Wright was an aircraft manufacturer. And especially in post-Depression era America, their facilities were not as big as, you know, the United States military would hope. On top of that, they were still supplying the United States Army Air Corps, Just a note, remember, the Air Force, as a separate branch, wasn't technically born until 1947, after World War II. So they were supplying the United States Army Air Corps with engines for aircraft and now tanks? The right company didn't quite have the right stuff. Oh man, I crack myself up. Fun fact, and I don't want to dig too deep into the company, but the Wright Company was the commercial aviation business of none other than Orville and Wilbur Wright. You know, the famed bicycle tinkerers and retailers that they were? No, I'm sorry. They were those people too, but also, no, the Wright brothers as in the Wright Flyer, the First Flight, Kitty Hawk, and all that shit. Sadly, Wilbur had already passed in 1912 of typhoid fever, and Orville had long since sold all of his shares of the Wright Company, which at this point had already merged with Glenn Martin's Martin Company, which had then merged with Curtiss Airplane Company to become the Wright-Curtiss Company. Oh wait, I'm sorry, nope, the Curtiss-Wright Corporation in 1929, where the Wright R-975 began its long and storied life as an engine. How does all this add up to our production woes? Well, the smaller production capacity of Wright was beginning to show, and the contracts that Roosevelt and Churchill had agreed upon demanded an insane volume of production. So, in order to remedy this situation, a licensing agreement was reached with Continental Motors. And actually, this agreement was made back in 1939, but the manufacturing itself did not kick into gear until about 1940 to 1941. Quote, "This was a fortuitous decision indeed, as Wright could only manage to produce 750 of the R-975 for tank use throughout their production, yet Continental was scheduled for 1,000 per month. The Continental version of the engine was designated the R-975 EC-2. End quote. Thank you, Mr. Doyle. Quickly, I want to add a note here. I previously stated that the tank version of the R-975 was the EC-2 model, or at least the upgraded tank model. That is incorrect. The R-975, that was both the upgraded and non-upgraded version, and you know, it would have still been known simply as the R-975 when it was built by Wright. Once it became a license-built engine, however, produced by Continental, the EC-2 was added to differentiate it from a Wright-produced model. Not a big deal, but I wanted to clarify. We'll basically just be calling it the R-975 from here on out, but know that the majority of these engines were produced by Continental and not by the Wright Company. Alright, now we've gotten some of those super early pre-production issues out of the way. I think we're ready to get on with the actual production of the Serial M3. But of course, like I want to do, we'll need to wind the clock back to the beginning of the production before getting to where we were. I know, it seems counterproductive, but I am trying to weave a narrative with conflicting timelines, and this is just the best way we have to go about it. We have previously discussed that producing tanks, especially in this period, was not as easy as, say, building a car. So, even though Mr. Knudsen was busy working his magic in Detroit, the only companies that had any experience assembling large pieces of heavy steel into even heavier steel vehicles would of course be the United States locomotive industry. I find it rather interesting, but when all is said and done, the solution just makes a lot of sense. The now ready for mass production M3 medium tank would be produced by the automotive plants, but the kicker was that they would then be shipped to and assembled at the locomotive facilities, as again, they had all of that experience with heavy applications. And this is probably more important, they had the facilities. And due to the Depression, they had the production capacity to do so. The two primary assembly lines would, of course, be the American Locomotive Company and the Baldwin Locomotive Company. There were some others, you know, I think Pullman got involved. There were others, but those were the two big ones. The contracts with both of these locomotive companies had already been signed in November of 1940. With production slated to begin at all deliberate speed, they would not actually be the first to produce the M3, technically speaking. And remember, technically correct is the best kind of correct. The very first M3 tanks produced would be done so at Rock Island Arsenal. Now, before I hand over the trophy to Rock Island, there may be a few of you yelling at your speakers right now. Save it. I have before me the original logs from Rock Island, which lends their credence on the matter. Four pilot M3 vehicles were to be constructed. Each type of hull fabrication would be assembled here for pilot testing. I will have posted several photos of the very first M3 medium tank pilot vehicle for everyone to behold. It's pretty cool, especially seeing all of the fanfare and public excitement for the M3 medium tank. It really reminds me of when they, christen a naval vessel. The report for the M3 pilot vehicle number 1 in February of 1941 shows the progress as follows. Quote, hull completed, except drilling for attaching parts. Transmission being installed. Suspension completed and installed. Tracks and sprockets completed. One set of turret rings completed and shipped to Aberdeen Proving Ground February 10, 1941. Controls. Drawings released to the shop February 12, 1941. Patterns completed and castings scheduled for delivery the week of February 24, 1941. Engine. Ready for installation, but waiting for the receipt of clutch throwout bracket casting, which is part of the controls. The 75mm T7 gun received at Rock Island Arsenal February 22, 1941. The 75mm gun tank mount completed with the exception of the cone worm and worm wheels, which are scheduled for delivery from Michigan Tool Company on March 10, 1941. Standard straight type worms and worm wheels have been manufactured and installed by the arsenal in order that this mount may be completed and proof fired. Proof firing of this mount is scheduled for the week of February 24th. I'm going to interject here. A worm wheel is a gear which has a worm or screw that runs parallel with the wheel. The wheel's teeth is driven by the screw, the movement of the worm. Anyway, it is estimated that this tank will be completed, ready for road test on March 8th, 1941. End quote. And these are coming straight from the Rock Island archives themselves. Quite the riveting tale. Let us continue. Quote, medium tank M3, pilot number 1. The manufacture of the medium tank M3 pilot, less the turret, has been completed at Rock Island Arsenal. This vehicle was operated approximately 35 miles, which was sufficient to bring all oiling systems up to proper temperature for observation. No undue troubles were encountered during this test run. The vehicle was shipped to Aberdeen Proving Ground on March 15, 1941, for further test. End quote. What I find rather interesting about this log is that they were obviously trying to get these vehicles very quickly assembled. They were just trying to run the basic preliminary test. 35 miles? That is not a lot of distance. I think I commute more than that in a day. But apparently, it is good enough to know that nothing is going to, seize up or immediately catch on fire. Good enough, full send. Now, I don't want to bore you with all of the logs, But the remaining excerpts I wish to dig into are going to be a little bit longer, and they will bring us just about up to speed for the pre-production, production, troubleshooting that we needed to get through before we get back to the minutiae. We've already covered the engine for one of the variants, at least. Remember, I warned you all this was going to be the full treatment. Quote, medium tank, pilot, M3, number 2. The status of the pilot tank M3 with cast hull from General Steel Casting Corporation is as follows. Casting for upper hull and plate for lower hull have been received and are being assembled. Assembly of the hull, 85% complete. All armor plate castings for gun mounts have been received and are in process of machining, 50% completed. Gun mount parts in process of machining, 50% completed. Suspension, 90% completed. Gas tanks, 75% completed. Interior parts of hull, racks, controls, subfloor, etc., in process of manufacture, 30% completed. The turret casting received was rejected. 10 items of armor plate castings received from Chrysler were also rejected. Every effort is being made to have replacements made as soon as possible. Medium tank pilot M3 number 3, the status of the pilot medium tank M3 with welded hull from Distin is as follows. A total of 10 hull plates have been received. Preliminary setups are being made for welded assemblies. All armor plate castings have been received, and it has been found that a number of these castings are to be rejected. The report continues into May. Pilot, medium tank, M3, number 2. The status of this tank with the cast hull from General Steel Casting Corporation is as follows. Turret casting received and rejected. Replacement has been received and is approximately 65% complete. It is estimated that the preliminary test of this tank will begin on May 27. Pilot, medium tank, M3, number 3. The status of this tank with welded hull from Distin is as follows. Welding of all sub-assemblies has been completed, and final welding will be completed on May 28, 1941. Completion of the tank is expected about June 16, 1941. End quote. We will have time to collect our thoughts after we finish these reports to summarize what all is going on here. But suffice it to say, there were still plenty of bugs in the system that would need some ironing out. Before the full might of mass production could be turned on for the M3. There is a lot of positive to be said, and lots of accolades to adorn the United States military machine, but it is, it too had a stage of infancy where problems were still abound. It should be noted that the persistence of the engineers and folks within the military, and all of the pre-production planning that went into setting up the, arsenal of democracy, plays at least as big of a role as any other in regards to the utter dominance and just the ass-kicking the Allies handed the Axis during the Second World War. Our report continues into June. Quote, medium tank pilot M3 number 3 with welded hull from Distin is as follows. Assembling and welding of the hull has been completed, and the suspension, gas tanks, and transmission all have been installed. Turret, interior parts, engine, etc. now in process of assembly. Preliminary road test scheduled to start on June 30th, 1941. Medium tank pilot M3 number 4 with welded hull from the Carnegie, Illinois Steel Company. Hull received, completely welded, suspension, and a majority of parts for this hull have been completed. End quote. Now, you might be wondering, what happened to pilot tanks number one and number two, don't worry, they haven't been left on the roadside or anything. They have been completed and sent to Aberdeen by this time, which is why they are no longer included in this particular report. So let's continue with July of 1941. Quote, medium tanks M3. The status of the two pilot medium tanks M3, now under manufacture at this arsenal, is as follows. The pilot medium tank M3 number 3 with welded hull plate, furnished by Diston, has been completed, road tested, and shipped to Aberdeen Proving Ground on July 2, 1941. Medium tank M3 with welded hull plates, furnished by the Carnegie, Illinois Steel Company, assembly and welding of hull completed. End quote. I will remind the listener that if the tone of each of these reports seems a little different, the phrasing, the quick retorts, comments, and the nomenclature are all kind of different, little, kind of unique. Best that I can tell is that a different engineer or officer was in charge of filling these out each month, and as such, we have different tones in the narrator's writing. Let's check in with their August and final report, at least in regards to the M3 pilot vehicles. Quote, the pilot medium tank M3 with welded hull number 4 from Carnegie, Illinois Steel Company has been completed. This vehicle, less the engine, less the transmission, less the turret, less the gun mounts, was shipped to Aberdeen Proving Grounds on August 9th, 1941. End quote. So now we've got pilot vehicles, mechanics, and all the pieces have been assembled. We know that each of the manufacturing plants, we only discussed the 4, was capable of fabricating the pieces required to assemble a fully operational M3 medium tank. We are going to need to revisit the armament a bit more. Since last episode, we really only discussed the very early bird models of the weapons in which the M3 was to be fitted. I will do my best to avoid any redundancies, but it is worth noting that some of the materials I was able to get my hands on over the break allowed me to dive a bit deeper into the M3 than the volumes of Sherman history I was using for the Sherman. But as I have lamented, we are doing a series within a series to go over the M3 in finer detail. I am not going to rehash how the low-velocity anti-aircraft T-6 gun was modified to be used as a tank cannon. I won't tell you that they needed to equip the weapon with a trigger-type firing mechanism to fire solenoid in lieu of a constant trigger-type mechanism, or how they needed to move the cam opening mechanism from the left side of the breech to the right-hand side, or how having to rotate the recoil mechanism and equipping the breech with an operating handle, that would be a waste of yours and my time. Hey, wait a minute. Okay, that's all the new info we missed when we last discussed this T-6, now designated the T-7 75mm tank cannon. Well, it wouldn't take long, and by April 24th of 1941, the Ordnance Committee approved the Mobile Artillery Committee's suggestion that the T-7 be renamed using the more standard U.S. nomenclature, and as such was born the 75mm gun M2. During testing of the installation, it was noted that the 84-inch or 213-centimeter long gun tube was out of balance. During the Aberdeen test of the pilot vehicles, once they got the gyro stabilizer in there, it became apparent that the weapon was out of balance by, just 3,618 pounds, or 1,641 kilos. So what? That's about a bison's worth of a difference, or my Toyota Corolla's weight of difference. What was the solution? Quote, Aberdeen recommended that the length of the tube be increased by at least 10 inches to compensate for this. End quote. I mean, who couldn't use a few extra inches? Off their waistline, of course. As luck would have it, or rather a great deal of foresight, the T6 medium tank project had already begun, which ultimately would become the M4 Sherman. Quick note, I think I've probably mentioned earlier in the Sherman, now the M3 series, just how a lot of these timelines are going to intersect, overlap, and otherwise become entwined. This is one of those times. Since we haven't officially begun our talks on the T6 medium tank, but rest assured, it is being developed alongside the production of the M3 medium tank. Okay, aside completed. With this T6 project in the works, the idea of increasing the length of the 75mm M2 gun was kind of initially scoffed at, but once someone did the math and they realized that they could fit that gun into the T6 turret, they also realized they could increase the tube to 100 inches, 254 centimeters, and the barrel would not extend beyond the hull of the vehicle. They further realized that the barrel could actually be stretched out to 112.9 inches, or 286.76 centimeters, without the gun extending beyond the tracks. Yeah, they did a little bit more testing, some further tinkering with the cannon, and it revealed that in order for the gun to be fully depressed, they were going to have to actually rotate the whole mechanism 90 degrees. Of course, this meant that extra modifications would be needed for the breech mechanism to work properly, and more importantly, safely. All told, this redesigned gun was now 118.375 inches or 300 centimeters long and was now designated the T8 during testing. The T8's longer tube compared to the M2 gun meant an increase in muzzle velocity. The M2 gun's barrel length of 31 calibers produced a muzzle velocity of 1,930 feet per second, or 588 meters per second. The T8 gun, on the other hand, with a barrel length of 40 calibers, produced a muzzle velocity of 2,030 feet per second, or 619 meters per second. These figures come from Stephen Zaloga's book, U.S. Anti-Tank Artillery, 1941 to 1945, in which he indicates that the muzzle velocity was tested using the standard M72 APT solid shot. This armor-piercing round weighed in at 13.9 pounds, or 6.32 kilos. It was a capable round, nothing spectacular. It would be replaced not too long. We're going to do a workup of all the different ammo types in a future episode, but for now, know that the most common round at the time, at least for armor piercing, was this M72. So if you're keeping track, the M3 fired a M72 out of an M2 mounted on the M1. Got it? Okay. On June 28, 1941, the Ordnance Committee approved the standardization of the T8 gun as the 75mm gun M3. This meant that the 75mm gun M2 would be reclassified as the, quote, substitute standard, end quote. This was done to better incorporate the M3 into the production lines as the M2 contracts were fulfilled. Since the production of the M3 medium tank had not paused for a new weapon, the M2 gun would have to do, well, for now. Finally, the plans were put in place and the Adjutant General approved them on July 15th of 1941. The Army was very insistent that this new and improved cannon be installed on the M3 medium tank without further delay. The reason behind this urgent decision was twofold. First, bigger gun, bigger kills. Second, the M2 gun procurement was kind of sketchy at first. So sketchy, in fact, that quite a few early production M3 medium tanks had only a dummy gun installed, which is a fancy way of saying a piece of pipe. Initially, there were only two producers, the Watervliet Arsenal of New York and Empire Ordnance of Philadelphia. Fun fact, Watervliet Arsenal is the oldest continuously operating arsenal in the United States. Founded in 1813 during the War of 1812 to increase ordnance production during that war. The arsenal has been running ever since. Today, they produce most of the Army's artillery, along with tank guns, mortar tubes, and cannons of all varieties. Historic arsenals aside, the M2 cannon production was just not keeping up with the projected production of the M3 medium tanks. Quote, in 1941, only Watervliet and Empire were producing M2 guns, with the combined production through December of only 1,216 guns. On the other hand, production of the M3 tanks for U.S. delivery only, excluding Great Britain, was 1,342 tanks. End quote. Both Watervliet and Empire would exclusively produce the M2 cannons throughout 1941. The order to produce the M3 cannon was received in June of 1941, but the first deliveries from Watervliet would not hit the shelves until March of 1942, and Empire would not begin shipping any M3 cannons until July of 1942. Because production shortages of the M2 cannon were well known by the planners as early as October of 1940, a third manufacturer would be added to the M3 medium tank program. C.H. Cowdrey Machines Works, which at the time was a precision tools manufacturer in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, contract in hand, the company would be bought out before they could produce a single M2 cannon. The firm that purchased the outfit was the American Type Founders Incorporated of Elizabeth, New Jersey. ATF, no, not that ATF, but American Type Founders, was incorporated in 1892 as a sort of cartel or conglomerate of several large type foundries in order to protect their interest and maintain quality and price control. I point this out because this company, the ATF, produced typefaces, not guns. And just in case you were unaware, typefaces, you know, the things that used to do all of the printing were usually metal and sometimes wooden typefaces, were used to produce letters and numbers for printing presses. Really, I only bring this up because we shall see throughout the Sherman series just how many non-war industries become war industries. It tickles me to no end that companies like IBM or International Business Machines would go on to produce things like the M1 carbine, or same with the National Postal Meter Company, also made carbines. And so when I say that the entirety of the United States switched over to war production, I'm really not kidding. So with the addition of ATF and other producers like Oldsmobile and General Motors, the M3 cannon production would finally outstrip the M3 medium tank production in April of 1942. Moving on to the next big-ish weapon on the M3 medium tank, we of course have to return to our friendly 37mm gun, the M3. I know, these M designations are going to get confusing, so that's why I try and say M2 gun or M3 medium so that you know when I say M3, Is he talking about the gun? Is he talking about the tank? What the hell? Anyways, the 37mm gun, M3, this was the same gun we had previously discussed earlier in the series, which had been developed for the T5 medium tank prototype series, along with the M2A4 light tank. The M3 gun would ultimately run into an issue of being too long for the M2A4 light tank, and it had concerned the Ordnance Department that the M3 gun could become damaged in close quarter fighting. So in order to adjust for this, they shortened the barrel by 6 inches, redesignated it the 37mm gun M3A1. And finally, in October of 1939, the M3A1 gun was redesignated the 37mm gun M5. The Ordnance Department was quick to recognize that a semi-automatic breech would better serve this weapon, as the lighter round of the 37mm could be fired in quick succession with the proper equipment fitted to it. Two important features that would help this project along was the introduction of a counter-recoil opened and spring-closed breech, meaning when the weapon was fired, the recoil forces were used to both eject the shell and then bust the breech wide open in order for the loader to throw the next round in. After throwing the round in, the spring would close the breech behind it, reducing both the effort and time needed between shots. This was dubbed the M5E1. The weapon was presented to Aberdeen in September of 1940, and a month later, on the 24th of October, the now semi-automatic M5E1 gun would be standardized as the 37mm gun M6, which reduced the status of the M5 gun to the, quote, substitute standard, end quote. Which, of course, is just like we saw with the 75mm M2 and M3 guns. The now standardized M6 gun, clocking in at 76.5 inches or 194 centimeters, firing a standard solid shot AP round, the M74, which weighed in at a minuscule 1.92 pounds or about 8 tenths of a kilo, or 0.87 kilos to be exact. This gun had a muzzle velocity of 2,900 feet per second, or 883 meters per second. This was, you know, acceptable at the time, especially with such a light round and a semi-automatic breech. The firing rate on the M3 medium tank with the 37mm cannon was, in theory, about 20 to 25 rounds per minute. Not bad. Not bad at all. During the testing phase at Aberdeen, it was noticed that, much like the 75mm M2 gun, the 37mm M6 gun was a bit off balance and rather breech heavy. It was again recommended that they add a few more inches to the barrel, which would, just like the M2 to the M3 gun, would increase the muzzle velocity. This increase was from 2,900 feet per second, or 883 meters per second, to, drumroll please, 2,955 feet per second, or 900.5 meters per second. Not a big increase, but still an increase. This would also increase the total length of the barrel to that of the 75mm M3 gun, which would help expedite the production process of the new 37mm M6 gun by 2 whole months. The Ordnance Committee would approve this modification on April 24th of 1941, stipulating that longer barrels not be used as replacement barrels for the 37mm M5 gun, which was still slated for continued use in the M3 light tank, and that the barrels be accordingly marked to differentiate the two. As a point of clarity, the M6 barrels would be the longer 118.375 inches or 300 centimeters barrel. Or you could also say 53 calibers. So you could write it all out as the 37 millimeter gun M6L53, to be specific. While the M5 barrel would continue to be the shorter 76.5 inch or 194 centimeter long barrel. This barrel, you know, this gun, the M5, would not receive the upgraded elongated barrel. It becomes further confusing because the M6 gun was ordered in January of 1941, meaning it would be equipped with the shorter barrel until April of 1941, when the longer barrel would be approved to be fitted on the M6 gun. However, luckily for us, none of the M6 guns would receive the shorter barrels, as production would not get underway until about March of 1942. Crisis averted. Once again, production of both the M5 and M6 guns would be bottlenecked at the Watervliet Arsenal, who, at this point, were in charge of producing all of the cannons for the American-bound M3 medium tanks. That's a big asterisk there, but still, my point stands. Watervliet was being pushed to the limit, producing both the 75mm M2 and M3 guns, and alongside they were also building the 37mm M5 and M6 guns. Something was bound to give. So just like we mentioned that early in 1940, while the production of the M5 was just getting started, much like the 75mm M2 production, additional manufacturers would be needed to meet the needs of the medium tank program. Enter the, and I'm not kidding here, the United Shoe Machinery Corporation of Beverly, Massachusetts. Like I said earlier, everybody was in on the war production. The contract was awarded in July of 1940, but production of the M5 gun would not begin until April 1941. An order was placed for the new M6 gun in October of 1941, but the eventual delivery of these would be too late for the medium tank program, as the first of these would not be completed until January of 1943, which, spoiler alert, was past the production cycle of the M3 medium tank. Of course, a couple of other firms would be added to the M5-M6 gun production list. The National Pneumatic Company of Rahway, New Jersey, whose primary production before the war was, quote, production of pneumatic door openers of the type used on streetcars and buses, end quote. Again, this just tickles me. And finally, the ATF was enlisted to produce the M5 and M6 guns alongside their pre-existing orders for the M2 and M3 75mm guns. ATF being the American type founders, as previously noted, it should also, you know, we should also probably say here that much like the M2 and M3 guns, the M6 gun production was unable to keep up with that of the M3 medium tank until about midway through 1942. To keep the tanks rolling, several M3 medium tanks would simply be fitted with the 37mm gun M5 if no M6 guns were available. Even though total production of the M6 gun would amount to 23,839 by the end of 1942 alone, the monthly production levels did not always match the number of M3 tanks being produced. Well, folks, thank you so much for your patience. I know we took a bit longer of a hiatus than I originally intended, but like all things, life just finds a way to get in the way. With that said, I think we've had a good run going in this week's episode. It was a little longer than I expected, but that's the Panzer podcast for you. With the exception of the additional engines, which of course we'll cover in due time, We've laid enough out to get into the M3, the M3A1, and the M3A2, which all used the radial R975 engines. The M3 being a fully riveted vehicle, the M3A1 had a cast upper and a welded lower hull. The M3A2 was in fact fully welded. I think we can squeeze all three of those variants into the next episode, though we shall have to see what I end up writing, so hang in there. But we're on the move, and you know what? We're back, baby, and we're back on schedule. So expect another episode in 2 weeks' time as we power through the medium tank M3 on our way to the promised M4 Sherman land. As always, I can be reached via email at thepanzerpodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at thepanzerpod, and on Instagram at thepanzerpodcast. The Panzer Shop is all stocked up with stickers if any of you are interested in supporting the show monetarily at thepanzerpodcast.bigcartel.com. If you like what we're doing here, I would appreciate a positive review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen, if possible, because it does help us reach new audience members, and I very much appreciate it. Until next time, I'm John Burgess. Thanks for listening.